From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The following are all true ghost stories from different parts of the world. Italy, the whispering ghost of Vercelli. Tito Schipa, the famous opera singer born in Lecce, Italy in 1890, was known for the sweetness and lyricism of his voice. Trained for 5 years by the renowned maestro Garunda, Tito made his operatic debut in La Traviata and became a success overnight. In 1919, after singing in numerous Spanish and South American cities, he went to America to become the leading tenor for the Chicago Opera Company. Thousands flocked to see and hear him in such works as Barbara of Seville, Lacme, Lucia, and Tosca. But only a few of Tito's intimates ever knew that he had several psychic experiences. One of these occurred when he was a young boy. Lying in bed one night, unable to sleep, Tito was amazed to see at the foot of his bed an apparition of a beautiful woman. She was wearing a Spanish veil and carried a fan. Tito saw her lips move as if she wished to say something to him, but he could hear no words. Then very slowly the apparition simply faded away before his eyes. Tito thought this a very strange occurrence, and he told his mother about it. But his mother pooh-poohed the boy's story and told him he had merely been dreaming. A few months later, Tito paid a visit to his uncle in Parma, where he had never been before. One day, Tito happened to be glancing through his uncle's family album of photographs with his mother, who had come with him to Parma. Presently, the boy came to a picture of his uncle's recently deceased wife. It had been taken in Spain at the time of their marriage. "Mama," he exclaimed, "look, this lady, she is the one I saw that night." Tito had never seen his uncle's wife, nor had he ever seen a picture of her. His uncle and mother questioned the boy closely about what he had seen. Soon it was ascertained that Tito had seen the lady's ghost on the same night as her death. Even more interesting was another incident that happened in Tito's early days of opera singing. It occurred in the town of Vercelli, where he had first made his debut in La Traviata. Tito was staying at an inn, a very old one, and he noticed that a strange atmosphere of gloom hung over the place. This somberness seemed to affect the entire personnel of the tavern, from the manager down to the stable boys. In time, Tito learned the reason. Everyone, including the manager, was afraid that the inn might have to be sold and that they would all lose their positions. For generations, the ancient tavern had always been inherited by the owner's eldest son, whose early life was spent in learning how to operate and manage the establishment. However, the father of the present manager and eldest son had died and left no will. Because there was no will, according to Italian law, the inn would have to be sold and the proceeds divided equally among the dead man's heirs. At one point, the inn became very crowded, and the manager asked Tito if he would mind giving up his large room to a married couple and take a smaller one. Tito liked the young man and said that he would not mind at all. The manager then told him that the only room he had left was the small one in which his father had died. Would that bother Tito at all? Tito replied that he had no foolish fears on that score, and he moved into it. On his first night in the room, he slept soundly until the morning. On the second night, he was not so lucky. Tossing fitfully for hours, Tito at last managed to drop off to sleep. Suddenly, He was awakened by a whirring noise that sounded like a big bird circling just above his head. Believing that a bat had flown in through the open window, Dito got up, lit a candle, and searched about the room. He could find no bird or bat at all. Returning to bed, Dito again fell asleep. But in the half-dawn, he was once more roused by a repetition of the eerie whirring noise just above his head. Only partially conscious, Dito came fully awake when he clearly heard some spoken words. The voice, sounding husky and uttering the words singly, said, "Look on left wall." The last word was almost inaudible. Whether Dito had dreamed this or not, he did not know for certain. At any rate, he arose and looked around in the dim light. The left wall of the room appeared to him no different from any of the other walls. It was wainscoted from floor to ceiling with oak paneling, and upon it hung an old oil painting. Dito smiled to himself at what seemed like a figment of his imagination and crawled back into bed. No sooner had he done so than he heard three sharp knocks against the wooden wainscoting of the left wall. Deciding that the disturbance must be due to a bat that was blindly seeking its freedom, Dito got up once again. This time he began to search more thoroughly, for he was annoyed at having his rest interrupted. Dito's next thought was that the bird or bat or whatever it was had gotten itself trapped behind the old painting. Dragging a table across the room, he climbed up on it and took down the picture. He saw that it was a rendition of the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian, a cruel and somber one, showing the bleeding wounds and arrows piercing the saint's body. Dito then turned the picture around and leaned the face of it against the wainscoting. There was no bird or bat or any other creature to be seen on the back of it at all. Before Dito climbed back up on the table to rehang the picture, something caught his eye. The daylight was getting stronger, and he saw the gleam of a piece of white paper. It was neatly folded and tucked in the back of the oil painting, between the wooden stretcher and the canvas. Pulling the paper out, Dito took it to a window to investigate. It proved to be the lost will, leaving the inn to the eldest son. At that moment, Tito felt himself break out in cold sweat. The wall dropped from his hands. He first thought was that the voice speaking to him must have been that of the dead father. Then Dito's reason began to refute this idea. Possibly his mind preoccupied with the story of the will, he had merely dreamed those words, or half awake, had simply imagined them. As for the whirring, knocking sounds, they might have been made by a bat or bird that had since flown away. But Dito was also a singer, and he was keenly sensitive in his response to surrounding influences. Often he found he was able to read the thoughts of those around him, much as an antenna of a radio receives sound. He was also, he knew, possessed of psychic abilities. Might not the same sensitive response to the hidden paper have inspired him, driven on by the half-dream, to the finding of the will? Whatever the explanation, there was the will, and his friend the manager was a happy man when Dito turned it over to him. From Japan, The White Lady of Yokosuka. Multiple witness cases involving apparitions are comparatively rare in psychic research. Their value lies in the fact that more than one observer has seen a ghostly form, thus confirming that what one person saw, others saw as well. One such case occurred shortly after World War II, when crewmen aboard a United States destroyer witnessed the same phantom while tied up at the United States Naval Base at Yokosuka in outer Tokyo Bay. In the summer of 1947, the destroyer lay alongside one of the many piers that accommodated American naval vessels at the Yokosuka base in occupied Japan. The dock was a high one, actually built to berth larger ships, so that when the men went ashore from the ship, they walked up the gangplank instead of down. From the deck of the low-lying destroyer, it was possible to see people on the long pier above, only if they were standing or walking fairly near the planking at the pier's edge. It was here that the apparition was seen by most of the crew. The destroyer had just finished a tour of picket duty with a small aircraft carrier. Now she was in port for a 3 weeks refitting, and the men were given plenty of liberty ashore. Although the destroyer returned afterwards to the same pier, the apparition was never seen again. It was on the third night in port that the phantom was first observed. During the mid-watch from midnight to 0400 hours, a wild-eyed young torpedo man burst into the quarter-deck area and began babbling to the officer of the deck that he had seen a ghost, sort of floating along, as he put it, on the pier above as he was standing his watch. The officer told the young sailor to calm down and tell him exactly what he had seen. Was it still there? No, the young man said. It had just glided down the long pier, past the ship, and then just kind of melted away. What had it looked like, the officer of the deck wanted to know. The sailor, calmer now, explained that it was clearly the figure of a woman, by the look of her hairdo and dress, a Japanese woman. He said that he had first caught sight of her as she came abreast of the ship, and that her form was transparent. He was able to see right through her as she glided on by. The officer then asked if there was anything else he had noticed about the figure. Yes, the sailor replied. She was dressed in what seemed to be some kind of white ceremonial kimono with a wide obi sash around her waist. Anything else? The officer asked. Yes, sir, answered the young man. She was carrying something in her hand, a perfectly square box, perhaps a foot square in all dimensions, and it too was white and tied with a dark ribbon. The officer took the boy back out on deck and told him to show him where he'd been standing when he saw the ghost. The sailor indicated a spot nearly opposite the turret of the 4-inch forward gun. He pointed up to the pier where he had first seen the apparition, then arced his finger along to the place where the phantom had melted away. No one was on the pier now, neither human nor ghost, and all that could be seen above the piling was the blue-black Japanese night sky. The officer shrugged and told the sailor to continue standing his watch. If he saw the figure again or anything else suspicious, he said, he was to report immediately. But nothing further was seen that night. 2 nights later, a chief boatswain's mate, an older man, was having a smoke on the foredeck before turning in. It was after midnight, and he couldn't seem to get to sleep. He had not been ashore that night and was perfectly sober. Just as he flicked a cigarette over the side, he happened to look up towards the looming pier. He later told a duty officer that he was astonished to see a Japanese lady dressed in white gliding along the edge of the pier. He swore he could see right through her. She had, the chief said, carried some kind of square box in her hands with a ribbon around it. So help me, sir, he said, it was a real ghost. Then he continued he had watched the white figure glide along the pier and slowly fade from view. The chief had been essentially the same figure as a torpedo man 2 nights before. 3 nights after this, a young gunner's mate came off liberty, checked in with the officer of the quarter-deck, and he, too, strolled forward for a last cigarette before hitting the sack. He had had a couple of beers at a local tavern in Yokosuka, but no more than that. Walking out along the long pier to the ship, he had seen no one, and he had come aboard alone. No sooner had he lit a cigarette than he happened to glance up at the old pilings and froze at what he saw. Like the other two men, he distinctly saw the phantom lady glide past the ship atop the pier carrying her square box. He watched the white figure simply melt away and then dutifully reported what he had seen to the officer of the deck. It was not long before the scuttlebutt about the mysterious white lady, as she came to be called by the sailors, spread throughout the ship. The three witnesses got together and checked their stories with each other. Each had seen the specter gliding along the pier, each had seen her carrying the box, and each had seen the figure slowly fade away. Eventually, word of the white lady reached the ears of the captain, who thought it might be worthwhile to convene an informal board of officers to listen to the men's stories one by one. This was done, and so earnestly did each man relate his story that the board saw no reason to doubt their word. By this time, just about everybody aboard was eager to get a glimpse of the ghostly white lady. Knots of curious men, officers included, gathered along the rails after midnight. All eyes peered upwards along the length of the pier, searching diligently for any movement. Not a thing was seen for the next 5 nights, and soon many of the men lost interest. But a dozen or so were still watching on the 6th night, when the white lady put in her next appearance. Some sailors made low whistles and whispered to each other as they witnessed the apparition above them glide majestically along the pier, clutching her square box, and then fade into nothingness. All agreed that the whole performance had taken less than a minute. Some commented that the phantom seemed to have a sorrowful look on her gauzy, transparent face. At any rate, this multiple witness occurrence rekindled everybody's interest in the ghost. Every man who was off duty after midnight crowded the starboard side of the destroyer's deck, their accumulated weight putting a slight list on the ship. On-duty cooks, engineer room men, and other below-deck personnel traded off portions of their work shifts to get a few minutes on deck to watch for the ghost. The ship's PA system was usually minimally used during these hours so as not to scare off the phantom lady. Nothing happened for the next 4 nights. In fact, though no one, of course, knew it at the time, the specter would show up only once more to the destroyer's crew. When she did, it was with a new variation. 3 more nights passed and nothing was seen. On the 4th night, all hands who were not on duty grew tense as the ship's bells sounded midnight. Men crowded the starboard rails, and some perched themselves a few feet up the gangway, but not too far lest the presence jinx the ghost and scare it away. Aloft on the pier there was no one. Many sailors had a gut feeling that this would be the night and had put money on it. Since the phantom's last appearance, no fewer than 3 white lady pools had been formed, and their pots had grown considerable. 45 minutes went by, and the men smoked nervously and talked in hushed whispers. Soon the ship's bell chimed 100 hours. Precisely 7 minutes later, somebody whispered loudly, "There she comes!" And indeed, the now familiar figure of the white lady was visible on the pier approaching the ship's fantail. The men watched her glide quickly along, holding her box gingerly as before. Soon the phantom was directly amidship. The fascinated sailors gaped in silence at the gauzy apparition and held their breaths. Suddenly one crewman whispered loudly, "Look, there's another ghost!" All eyes swung to positions several feet beyond the destroyer's bow. There, on the pier's edge, stood what appeared to be the filmy outline of a Japanese soldier. He was holding out his arms to the approaching white lady in a gesture of humble entreaty, or so it looked to the watching sailors. But the white lady just glided on, oblivious, and seemed to the men to pass through the form of the ghostly soldier, The latter was then observed to turn slightly, still supplicating the white lady with his outstretched arms. In a few seconds, both figures faded slowly from view, never to be seen again by the destroyer's crew. During the last few days in port, the ship buzzed with talk about the strange event. The men traded stories to see whether any of them had seen something different from the others. But everyone had seen the identical pageant of events. A hopeful vigil was still kept after midnight by many men, but in vain. With new picket duty orders, the ship was soon back out to sea. The cruise lasted for 8 weeks, and when word was passed that their ship would again tie up at the same pier in Yokosuka, the men speculated on the chance of getting another glimpse of the white lady, but no one aboard ever saw her again. Back in port one evening, just 2 days before his ship was slated for sea duty again, the captain was having a drink with a fellow officer at the officers' club. The captain had been telling him about the odd appearance of the ghostly lady. The fellow officer thought a while and then suggested the captain might have a talk with the old harbor master at Yokosuka, who might possibly know something about the strange affair. Out of curiosity, the captain did so. The old harbor master nodded understandingly as the American officer related what he and his men had seen. Yes, he himself had once seen the same spectral figure from his patrol boat after midnight. "Habermaster-san," said the captain, using the Japanese respectful form of address, "do you know what it means?" The old Japanese man nodded. During the war, he said, this same pier had several times been used to unload dead Japanese servicemen, many of whom had been cremated. A mass ceremony for the dead had usually been held on the pier, and mothers, wives, and other relatives had afterward come to claim their men's bodies or carry away the bones of their ashes. Possibly, speculated the harbor master, the white lady had been one of these women. Perhaps, he continued, she herself was now dead and haunted the pier in a reenactment of the grief she had felt on that day. Of the phantom soldier, who knew? Perhaps he had been her dead son or husband, whose spirit had been present when she had claimed the box containing his ashes. Later, the puzzled captain debated with himself whether he should share this macabre information with his officers and crew. Finally, he decided against it. Why get them all stirred up again? Besides, he wanted their minds clear for their next tour of sea duty. From Norway, the Vardøger Ghost of Oslo. Psychic investigators have always been baffled by so-called arrival cases. In such cases, a person or persons is seen by others to arrive at a place before he or she actually gets there in the flesh. In Norway, for some reason, arrival phenomena are fairly common occurrences. They are called Vardøger, or forerunners. For instance, a man is heard or seen by his family to arrive home. He may hang up his hat, light his pipe, even say hello. Then he disappears. A few minutes later, he really does arrive, this time in the flesh. The family thinks nothing of the preliminary occurrence, knowing it simply means that Dad is due to arrive home soon and it's all right for Mom to start the dinner. While a number of theories have been advanced to explain the ghostly Vardøger arrivals, none have really done so satisfactorily. Of them, two are more plausible than the rest. The first concerns the theory of astral projection, also known as out-of-body experiences. According to this theory, there's a temporary separation of the astral or second or spirit body from the physical body. In Vardøger cases, the person in question is thinking intensely of the place to which he is going, usually a pleasant place such as home, where comforts and loved ones await him. He strongly anticipates his arrival and what he will do when he gets there. In so doing, he unconsciously wills his second or spirit body to separate from his physical one and project to his destination. His physical self may, for instance, be trapped on a long, boring train ride or faced with another half hour's walking time before his arrival. But his second body, momentarily willed free and unencumbered by either physical matter or time, arrives instantly at the longed-for destination. There, in some way, briefly takes on the materialized quality of an apparition, then vanishes again. The second theory suggests that somehow the element of time is out of joint. In other words, the Vardogor occurrence is a duplication of an event in time. The coming event takes place twice, once in a preliminary time, then again at its own time. But the Vardogor ghost of the man involved in this case involved a new variation on the arrival case, namely a larger gap in time between events. During the summer of 1955, Erickson Gorick, a successful American importer, decided to go to Norway to investigate the purchase of some china and glassware in that country. A widely traveled businessman, Gorick had never been to Norway, though for several years he had declared his intentions of visiting the land of the Fjords. But something else had always come up, and he had kept on postponing the trip until 1955. Arriving at Oslo in July, he asked where he might find the best hotel in the city. Then he took a taxi directly there. Gorick, it must be emphasized, knew no one in Oslo or, in fact, the whole of Norway. As Gorick signed the register at the hotel's desk, the room clerk smiled pleasantly at him and remarked, "I'm so glad to see you again, Mr. Gorick. It's very good to have you back." Astonished, the importer replied, "I'm sorry, but you must be mistaking me for someone else. I've never been here before." The clerk, however, insisted that he had been in the hotel a few months previously and had made his July reservation at that time. It was, the clerk told Gorick, his rather unusual name and American appearance that had stuck in his mind. "But it just can't be so," Gorick protested. "I've never, ever been in Norway before." "Then, sir," the clerk said, catching a glimpse of the hotel manager looking his way, "I must be mistaken. I do hope you'll forgive me." Matters grew more puzzling for Erickson Gorick when he visited the wholesale dealer whom he had planned to see about the glassware in China. Mr. Olson, a friendly, white-haired man, rose from behind his desk and offered the American a hearty hand clasp. Before Gorick could speak, Mr. Olson exclaimed, "How wonderful that you did get back, Mr. Gorick. You were in such a hurry last time that we weren't able to conclude the final details of our business." Completely stunned, Gorick slumped back into a chair in Mr. Olson's office. Surely, he thought, the man must be taking him for someone else, just as the room clerk had. "Tell me," queried the American, "when was I last here?" "Why," Olson answered, looking perplexed, "it was just a few months back." With a sigh of resignation, Erickson Gorick appealed to the Norwegian glass dealer. He explained that he had never been to Norway in his entire life before, and that he could prove it. Yet he added, everywhere he went, hotel clerks, waiters, and now he, Mr. Olson, recognized them and spoke of former visits. Mr. Olson listened carefully to Erickson Gorick's story without interruption. When he had finished, he began to explain to him about the Norwegian Vardogor. To the American, it all sounded like a fantastic fairy tale. "I can offer you no concrete explanation for our Vardogor," Mr. Olson concluded, But it is not such a rare thing as psychic phenomena go, at least not here in Norway. You really shouldn't let the experience upset you too much.